This is Fresh Air. We're going to conclude our Veterans Day salute by replaying a portion of Terry's 1999 interview with Robert Kotlowitz, who wrote a memoir about his experiences as a soldier in the Second World War. The memoir is called Before Their Time. Kotlowitz describes his experiences as a college student drafted into the infantry in 1943. After basic training, Kotlowitz, who was Jewish, was sent with the 26th Division to the French countryside to fight the Germans when he was 19 years old.
I want you to describe what it was like for you to be fairly new in the war and living in a foxhole.
Well, the first thing was that it was very scary. What was threatening was that we were facing German troops across a no man's land that was perhaps 200 yards wide, if that. It was a very static period in the war, not unlike World War I. And the tension that built up by just staying in a foxhole and unable to get out unless you were called for night patrol or were sent back for food and ammunition to replenish what you didn't have, that tension was really awful. And as a kid, I was really very scared.
You describe how the Germans would taunt you through a megaphone. So what were some of the things they would say?
Well, they would first tell us that Franklin Roosevelt was a Chew, as they called it, C-H-E-W. And they would tell us that New York had been flattened by German bombers and Seattle wiped out by Japanese bombers and that the Statue of Liberty had been sunk and, you know, things like that. Things that you knew immediately were hilariously false. And that had no effect on us at all.
What happened in the first few seconds when you and the rest of your troop got out of your foxholes?
What happened was that we formed a diamond formation. It was the whole platoon, and the leader of the platoon, Francis Gallagher, moved out very quickly to the head of it, and we started across that no man's land. It was still dark, and at the first break of light, we were moving up those rises, and the head of the diamond was already at the top and almost over when the Germans had us with machine guns. They took us with a sweep of machine guns and mortar fire and then rifle fire and grenades. And our platoon lieutenant, Francis Gallagher, was shot within 10 seconds of our ascent of those rises. He was shot through the neck. Probably both carotid arteries were destroyed at the same time, and he was gone. The rest of us fell instantly against this assault of so many weapons, and I don't know how many died in the first assault or how many died in the second assault, but the assaults went on for the entire day, and this was 6 in the morning. By 6 in the evening, there were only 3 of us left alive. 2 were wounded. One was unwounded, and I was the unwounded one.
How many men were killed?
I never really got the figure straight, but I would guess it is 37 or 38, maybe even as many as 40.
You survived by playing dead for about 12 hours. The Germans were walking around with guns, picking off people who appeared to be alive but wounded. How did you play dead for that long?
Well, I just want to say that they were not walking around. We never saw the Germans. They stayed in their foxholes, if that's what they were occupying.
Uh-huh.
And they had formed a semicircle into which we had walked. That's exactly what happened. And they surrounded us on 3 sides. They did not have to appear. They just had us perfectly. And I survived by just... I began to count very, very slowly in order to get my breath slowed down so that I would not be breathing in a normal way. And that's what I did for several hours, and I lay there for 12 hours without moving, and that was it, hoping, in fact, that I might get a kind of respectable wound that would enable me to concentrate on, you know, a wound in the thigh, the fleshy part of the thigh, so that I could concentrate on that and forget about my own anxieties. I had the feeling that if I were wounded, my fear would lift and disappear. I would have gotten it.
As you lay playing dead in the mud, you were listening to your buddies die. What did you hear?
Well, the sounds that I heard were the worst sounds I have ever heard, and I do feel that the sounds of war are the worst part of it. I heard young men screaming in terror and pain, calling for their mothers in some cases, which is the saddest call of all. Some of them speaking in a language I had never heard, including my friend who I shared the foxhole with. He was grunting a kind of animal-like way all day, violently thirsty. I could not get him any water. And those sounds were almost worse than the sounds of the machine gun rounds and the grenades and the mortars and the snipers. It's unbearable to hear people you have trained with for months and months to listen to them die in a helpless way and be unable to give them any help at all.
What was the first scene you saw when you picked your head up out of the mud?
It was a kind of litter of bodies, most of which I knew were dead, and three upright young Americans wearing Red Cross armbands carrying two stretchers.
You must have had such conflicting emotions when you emerged, the exhilaration of having survived and the agony of having lost just about everyone who you trained with.
I was in terrible shock, although part of me was functioning in a very clear way. I mean, I saw everything that I saw, heard everything that I heard, and processed it the way I normally did, but my system was in terrible shock. I no longer was afraid. When I stood up and spoke to the medic and then helped the third medic carry the dead GI back, I was no longer afraid. I mean, it was about 500 yards to company headquarters, and I made that move feeling just exalted is not the word, but it's not far from it. I think I was running on the last of my adrenaline, and that it was getting me to the end, and that when I got to company headquarters, it sort of vanished again, and I began to shake, tremble, and all the things that you do when you're in shock. And that's how I felt when I got out of there.
Now, you're Jewish. You were fighting in the French countryside against the Germans. Your dog tags had an H for Hebrew on it, and you write in your memoir about how you'd lie in your foxhole and wonder, well, should I maybe take these dog tags off? Say I get captured by the Germans and it says right here, I'm Jewish.
Yes. It was something that, for a short period in combat, worried me. And I thought, if I were captured, would I go to an ordinary conventional PW camp, or would I be sent to a special camp for Jewish soldiers? And I finally decided my dog tags were the only thing that really identified me, and that I would wear them the way everybody else was wearing them. And then I discovered just a year ago that there actually were those camps in which Jewish soldiers who were captured were sent to do kind of slave labor work. And I had no idea that that really was going on at the time.
Do you think in that sense that the Army made a mistake in identifying your religion on your dog tags?
Well, the identification was really intended for burial purposes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to be killed during the war, then the Army wanted to bury you in a way that was faithful to your faith, assuming you had a faith. But you had to have some kind of identification. You couldn't say I was an A for atheist. And I think, given the time, given 1943, 1944, there was probably no choice in the matter. I mean, soldiers were identified on their dog tags by religion, just as they were by their blood type.
Now, the publication of your memoir, and your book was first published in hardcover a couple of years ago, has just come out in paperback, has coincided with this whole revival of interest in World War II, from Saving Private Ryan to the Tom Brokaw bestseller, The Greatest Generation. And I'm wondering what you make of that revival of interest and the way it's being treated.
Well, I think most of it began on the 50th anniversary of VE Day, which mm-hmm. was about 3 years ago. And I think people began to suddenly be aware that the veterans of World War II were beginning to disappear. I mean, considerably more than half of the men and women who served in the United States Armed Forces in the war are dead. So the real memory of it is going, and I think people are becoming conscious of that. I've had hundreds of letters about this book, and a significant strand of letters comes from the sons of World War II veterans who had died and who had never spoken to their sons about their experiences. Because that's not what you did. It's not what you talked about at the dinner table with your kids. And they're now desperate to try to find out how their parents, how their father lived, what happened to a GI. And some of them are really obsessed by this.
Robert Kotlowitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Kotlowitz, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. He died in 2012 at age 87. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II, 620,000 are still living.